Governor, thanks for joining us again on Dakota Midday. Always nice to have you on the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, this has been a rather busy week for you. It's the opening of the 2015 session. Last Saturday was your inauguration for a second term. I would like to start there. What does it mean to you to be starting a second term now as governor after having the initial 4 years?
Well, it's certainly exciting again. I would say it's a little bit less anxious for me. The first term, of course, I was in the middle of choosing a cabinet, hiring a staff. We were dealing with the budget, which was upside down, and I was brand new to the job. So for a lot of reasons, I was much more anxious. This time it was, I have a staff that's very competent, I have a cabinet that's very competent. We had our legislative proposals pretty well put together, and so I was more excited and less anxious, I guess, this second time around.
So you're able to just jump into it and get back to work when the session opened up.
Yes, a lot better than, yeah, a lot different than 4 years ago, surely.
Now, you had your State of the State address on Tuesday. One of the major things you talked about was your proposal for roads and bridge projects, which includes $50 million in new taxes and fees. Is this an acknowledgement that South Dakota has a problem with its transportation infrastructure?
Actually, if you look at our roads for which the state is responsible, that is the interstates, the U.S. highways, and the state highways, they are in pretty good shape right now, unusually so, and that's in large part a consequence of a big influx of stimulus money that we received just a few years ago. So that allowed us to accelerate a lot of our programs, a lot of our projects, I should say, and improve our maintenance. And so our roads, probably those that are in excellent or good condition, are probably the highest percentage of our total roads that they've been in a long time. But that big infusion of federal stimulus dollars really masks the fact that our road funding has been stagnant. The gas tax, as an example, hasn't been looked at since 1999, 16 years ago. It's still at the same 22 cents a gallon that it was 16 years ago, but road construction costs have slightly more than doubled since then, and so we've still got that same 22 cents per gallon trying to stretch to pay for twice as much cost for the same amount of roadway. So even though our roads are in good shape at the state level right now, we know they will trend downward, and in just a few years we'll be starting to reach a point where it will cost more and more and more to maintain our roads, because it's a lot cheaper to maintain a good or excellent roadway than it is to try and maintain a fair or poor roadway. So it makes sense to spend money while the roads are good and excellent, and to keep them that way as long as possible, then wait for them to fall into lower categories, and then you really have to dig deep, and the money goes a third as far or a quarter as far as it would if we were stretching it while our roads were in great shape. Now that's the state roads, and then you've got a whole nother set of roads, county and local township roads. In fact, those are most of our road miles. Now, they don't carry the traffic that the state roads do. We carry about two-thirds of the traffic and 80% of the heavy truck traffic. And to put that in perspective, how important it is to know that, one legally loaded truck creates as much wear on the roadway as 9,600 cars. So we've got 80% of those heavy, legally loaded trucks on our state highways, so it's a concern for us. But at the local level, they have concerns about their roadway conditions too. Many of the roads, and especially their bridges, were designed in decades gone by for traffic that's much, much lighter than the traffic it's bearing today. 10 times lighter traffic when some of those gravel roads were designed than the trucks that are that they're expected to carry today.
Now, speaking of the federal dollars, I believe you mentioned in your state address that this is something that in the future we might not be able to rely on.
Right. The Federal Highway Trust Fund is Their revenue stream is primarily the federal gas tax, just as the state of South Dakota charges 22 cents per gallon. Every time you put a gallon of gas in your car, you pay 22 cents of state gas tax. You also pay 18.4 cents of federal gas tax. And it's been even longer since that was changed. That, I think, goes back to 93 since that was changed. And in fact, Congress has not even been restricting itself to spend the dollars that raises. For a while, it was raising more than the Highway Trust Fund was paying out. And so the Highway Trust Fund built up for a while. Well, then after that occurred, Congress said, well, let's spend more of this money because it's building. Well, they went too far the other way. And so what's happening now in recent years is they've been spending more than the dollars coming in. And in fact, about, I think, is it $15 billion more in 1 year that they're spending than comes in? So that Highway Trust Fund is expected to last with general funds from the federal government through May of this year, and then it will be out of money again. So Congress is going to have to decide what to do. Our congressional delegations say the amount of spending that South Dakota gets from federal funds is probably our best hope is that it won't go down. In fact, our federal funding has been going down slightly for the last 4 years. It peaked in 2010. It was a little bit less in 11, a little bit less again in 12, and in 13 again lower, 14 still again lower. So it's some commentators call it the gradual disappearance of the Federal Highway Trust Fund.
Now, your proposal includes the $50 million in new taxes and fees. How difficult was it for you to make that decision that it's necessary to raise taxes and fees in this situation?
Well, first of all, I had to be convinced of the need. I wasn't confident of that. And if you think about it, if you drive down a road and I drive down a road, having traveled that same piece of road, your attitude about that road might be different than mine. You might say, well, this is perfectly good. I'm happy with this road condition. I might be a little fussier and say, well, you know, this is not good enough. We need to have a better road condition than this. So my concern at first was, how objective is our assessment of the road conditions in South Dakota? And what I've learned is that our State Department of Transportation is very objective. We have a spider van, it's called, and I showed a picture of that during the State of the State, and I'm going to bring that van to Pierre so the legislators can see it. It has lasers, it has cameras, and it drives up to 15,000 miles of roadway in South Dakota every year, and it measures how much rutting there is, length of cracks, depth of cracks, width of cracks, what the pavement roughness is as a matter of vibration. So it's a very, very objective measure of our roadway conditions. And based upon that objective measure, we have also a computer program that can analyze, based on South Dakota costs that we have experienced and we know what car costs are, how much more money we need to maintain the excellent roads, how much money we need for the good roads, for the fair roads, and for the poor roads. And we know that it's most efficient to have about 80% of our roads at any point in time either excellent or good condition, and about 20% fair or poor. Now you might say, why would you want any of your roads in poor condition? Well, if you're going to rebuild that road next year, you might let it go for a year in poor condition rather than stick money in that's wasted because you tear that road up the next year. So I am very confident that we could spend $150 million annually on our roadways. But I don't think that the South Dakota voter is interested in paying that kind of money. And I think we can approach this in a much more gradual system. We can raise the gas tax by 2 cents next year, and especially in today's low gas prices, a 2 cent a gallon increase is, it will be imperceptible to the average consumer. And then raise it another couple cents the next year, and then the next year. And so very gradually ease into a tax increase that, that everyone should be able to manage because it's so gradual and so small. But I first had to be convinced of the need, and I am convinced of that. Beyond the road need, we also have an important bridge need, especially in the counties and townships. And if you go to look at our bridges, we have over 5,000 bridges. And what's a bridge in South Dakota? Well, of course, you and I might think we know what a bridge is, but in South Dakota, we count any kind of structure that helps us get over some kind of a waterway, whether that waterway is flowing all the time or flowing just in the spring. Any kind of structure, so it might be a series of culverts, or it might be what we think of a bridge where it's suspended on two ends and is up in the air. But any structure that's 20 feet long or more is a bridge. And our state Department of Transportation inspects every one of them. And it doesn't matter whether it's a state bridge that we're supposed to take care of or whether it's a township, a bridge on a township road or on a county highway. We inspect every single one of them. And we know of those bridges that are over 5,000, almost 6,000 bridges, in fact, about 1,400 of them are either functionally obsolete or structurally deficient. Doesn't mean they're unsafe necessarily, but they might be, they might have a very minimal weight allowance, so they're almost unusable because they can bear so little weight because they were designed so long ago. Or they might be structurally deficient, where maybe their guardrails are too narrow, or for whatever reason, they either just can't bear the traffic that today's trucks and cars present, or they're too narrow, or they need to be replaced. And just replacing those bridges would be $240 million if we did them all at once. Again, so I'm not proposing $150 million a year to spend on roads. I'm not proposing $240 million to replace all our bridges. I'm saying let's do $50 million in the first year and then gradually move it up a little bit year by year till we get to the point. And it'll take a number of years to get us to keep us from falling and falling and falling into more and more poor and fair roads. But we'll gradually slip down a little bit, and then we'll come back up, and then we'll be in an efficient condition. So that's the proposal.
Now, that's different from the proposal that is in a Senate bill based on recommendations from the Interim Highway Needs and Financing Committee. They want to raise $100 million for transportation. So the difference between your bill and the Senate bill, is it just a matter of money, or is it more the way it's being implemented gradually?
I'd say it's a little of both. The initial price tag for the interim financing committees is $100 million rather than $50 million. Ours ramps up, starts slower and ramps up more gradually for a longer period of time. Theirs starts a little higher and then doesn't have to ramp up over such a long period of time. We both, I think, get to a point where the dollars available will sustain our roads. My proposal will take us a little longer to get there, but eventually it will get there.
Now, you said in your State of the State address that there's a difference between being cheap and being frugal. You say you're being frugal here. Mike Valley was on the program yesterday. He's the Senate Transportation Committee chairman, and he led that interim committee as well. And he said that maybe you're being too frugal.
Well, I think reasonable minds can differ about how you approach this. Certainly, it would be great to be able to solve all our problems sooner. And I recognize that. But at the same time, you have to acknowledge the people who are bearing the burden of the tax increases are bearing a burden. And how much burden do you want to place upon them, and how quickly do you want to place it upon them? One of the things that I have to evaluate is what's doable. and what will get enough votes and what will satisfy the stakeholders. And so after the interim committee's report came out and their proposed bill came out, and I want to pause right there and say I very much appreciate all the work that Mike Valley did. He has been a stalwart in this area. He has studied it. He's worked very hard on it. He has been a voice for more investment in roads for years. And I think now we've reached some critical mass in that he's elevated the public awareness about this issue. And we're at a point, especially now when gas prices are so low, it gives us a little room to address this problem without impacting people too adversely. So I really give Senator Valley and his committee a lot of credit for all the work they did. And in fact, I use a number of the things that they propose in my proposal as well. With a little bit of tweaking, I left some things out that they had in. I ramp up a little bit differently than they did. But it's not significantly different in the end.
Another issue discussed during your State of the State address, Governor, was juvenile justice reform, and we'll talk some more about that later this hour with Chief Justice Gilbertson, who's also supporting that reform. What is at the focus? What is the basis of this juvenile justice reform here in South Dakota?
Well, it arises in part from what we learned in adult corrections reform over the last couple of years. We initiated a work group to look at our adult system because we realized we were locking up a lot of nonviolent offenders, nonviolent adults in our prisons, and our prison population was growing rapidly, and we were going to get to the point where we had to build a new women's prison or we'd have to build a new men's prison. Actually, both. We'd have to do both based on the trends we were seeing. And we also had to look at, well, maybe that's the right thing to do. I thought at first this is probably lock more bad guys up, make our streets safer. But in fact, it wasn't having that effect. And so what we realized is we needed to look at all these nonviolent offenders who maybe had addiction issues or other kinds of dysfunctions, and could we treat them in the communities, let them continue to work, but hold them accountable through very close supervision, probation or parole, and reward them for perfect behavior by shortening their length of supervision if they behave. And in fact, we implemented a program where if I'm on parole and I behave perfectly for a month, then I get a month cut off my parole period. And if I fall by the wayside, the next month, there's a swift and certain sanction. I may get put in jail for a couple of days to slap me back into order, I guess. But I don't get sent to prison for 2 years based upon an infraction. And so tried to make the penalties proportionate to the infractions and also provide rewards for those who could learn to discipline themselves, say no instead of going to the bar. So we learned all those things in the adult reform system, those things that were working in other states, and we implemented them in South Dakota. And it's very early. It's very early, but the adult corrections reforms seem to be working. Our prison population has flattened out. Our women's prison has actually population has actually gone down. We're below 400 for the first time in decades. And so when we said, gee, we did a study of the adult system, let's look at our juvenile system, see if we can make any improvements there. Maybe not. But one thing that we learned is that we have the second highest juvenile incarceration rate in the nation. South Dakota does. Even though our juvenile crime rate's falling, we're still locking up juveniles, not locking them up, but sending them to some kind of a residential out-of-home placement. And in some cases, they are insecure environments where they cannot leave. And we're doing that, again, for primarily juvenile offenders that are committing misdemeanor offenses, drug offenses, or alcohol offenses, low-level offenses. some things that are even not a crimes if adult would do them. You know, underage alcohol possession, truancy, you know, not showing up for school. So we are looking at a series of reforms that would instead try to divert those youth away from these residential placements, and also trying to incent those that go to a residential placement toward a more quick treatment, because even though we're sending fewer, we're still the second highest rate in the nation, and those we're sending to a residential placement out of home, they're staying longer. And so those are very expensive placements, and they're not proven to be more effective than the lower cost community-based treatments. So that's the essence of the effort underway. And we had a work group, the Chief Justice and I and legislative leaders all put together a work group that studied this issue last year. They met seven times, and this group was judges and law enforcement officers, legislators. We had input from over 200 stakeholders, and we have a lot of support for this product that we're offering in the form of legislation. The Sheriff's Association supports it. The County Commissioners Association supports it. Attorney General supports it. States Attorneys Association supports it. Defense attorneys support it. So we've got both sides of that coin supporting it. So I feel pretty good about it.
The interesting thing about this, as well as the Public Safety Act that was passed a couple of years ago, is that it seems like there's a broad base of support. What is it about this issue, while other issues, keep getting discussed year after year, there's never quite any sort of agreement on it, but on these issues it seems like everyone comes together and kind of sees that this is the right way to go. What is it about these issues that seems to result in this agreement?
I think it's process. It's all driven by the right process. In both cases, we did not come to the table with our solution, but rather identified some indicators that there might be opportunity for improvement and said, let's get all the stakeholders together and look at this together. So again, we've got the Chief Justice, myself, legislative leaders appointing this work group in early 2014, and then they spent all summer and fall looking at this, getting a lot of information from other states. We enlisted support from the Pew Charitable Trust, and they assigned some staff to help crunch all the data, because we can produce a lot of data in government. We don't always do a good job of analyzing it, nor in comparing it to other states and seeing, well, how do we look compared to the others, and what are they doing? Because we don't always have time or know what processes other states are following successfully. So first, the work group studied all this data, looked at evidence-based practices that were working in other states, and then said, well, what lessons can we learn from those two things and apply them to our situation here in South Dakota? And so they came out with 12 recommendations, and that 12 recommendation report last November, I think it was, or early December, formed the guidance to create legislation. And our office took the lead in crafting a first draft, but then we went back to all these stakeholders. We sat down with the prosecutors. Now look at this draft. Where are we going wrong here? We went to the Chief Justice. What's wrong with this draft here? How can we improve this? And so the stakeholders all had input in making the final product that is being introduced the best it can be. And because everyone had that input and had lots of time to look at it, that's why they're endorsing it as we introduce it.
When will this be introduced?
I think next week.
Next week.
I think next week, maybe even this week.
Now, as we come, as we begin this legislative session, other things that you would like to, we only have a couple of minutes here, just quickly, are there, what would you like to see as the end result of this session? Even though a lot of things can happen over the course of a session, some unexpected things, what would you like to see get done?
Well, of course, the budget is always high on my list of priorities. When I came into office, it was such a difficult thing for everyone to make the cuts that we made. And of course, that's no fun for anyone making the cuts, and it's certainly no fun for those who have to adjust and adapt to the cuts. So we want to avoid that. And the best way to avoid that is to never spend more money than you're getting in. And it's hard to judge what you're going to get in. Here we are in January, and we have to project what revenue we'll start getting in next July and then in August. So we're looking ahead several months to the beginning of the year, and then we're looking ahead still 12 more months and trying to judge what kind of revenue we'll get in. Now, happily, our revenue is not extremely volatile. You compare it to other states, much more volatile than ours. At the same time, it can be overestimated. There's a great temptation on everyone's part to stretch for more revenue projection, because then that allows expenditure at that level. So if you've got a project that costs a couple million bucks, if you can say, well, gee, I think revenue is going to be a couple million higher than you're suggesting it will be, well, then suddenly you can afford that program and your budget is balanced, at least when you adopt it. Now, so it's important to have a revenue projection that is conservative, conservatively low, and an expense projection, because some things we can't project. I mean, I can project what I'm going to spend on someone's salary, but I can't always project what our Medicaid expenditure will be, because that depends upon how many people fall into that low-income category, whether they break their arm or have cancer. And so you can't project what your Medicaid expenditures are, but you got to project them conservatively high. So expenses hopefully will come in below that number. Revenue comes in above the conservative, and so you've got a little cushion on both sides. This year, we did not hit the revenue target the way it's looking. Our revenue is coming in less than the legislature adopted. Happily, on the expenditure side, we projected conservatively high enough that we've got enough room there to cover the misjudgment in revenue. So that, I don't mean to go on and on about the budget, but it is so important to everything we do, because if you don't have the money for it, you can't have a program. So that, of course, highway funding is obviously a top priority this year. That's a two-thirds vote of both houses of the legislature. So I've got a lot of encouragement to make to the legislators, and hope citizens who believe, as I do, that we need to start taking some steps, that they'll encourage their legislators to support highway funding this year. And then juvenile justice, I think that looks like we'll have good support, but you never know. We want to make sure we're attentive to that. Another thing that didn't really come up during the State of the State is contagious disease management. With the Ebola scare and the recent measles outbreak here and the flu struggles we've had and deaths from flu here in South Dakota, it just made us even more aware how important it is that the Department of Health have the ability to contain contagious disease carriers and manage those kinds of things, so a small problem doesn't become any more widespread than it should. And we looked at our contagious disease control statutes, and we have some statutes that give the authority to do what we need to do, say for an Ebola, for a visitor who returns to South Dakota having visited Sierra Leone. And we've had good cooperation from the very few people in South Dakota like that. But it's maybe not as clear as it should be. And it's also interesting, as you look at our statutes, there's a lot of very specific language in there from the 50s and 60s related to tuberculosis control. And of course, we still have tuberculosis here and there in South Dakota and still need to manage that. But here we have this tremendous statutory framework for tuberculosis and a very modest framework for every other contagious disease. And so we're going to come forward with a proposal to repeal most of those disease-specific statutes, for the most part, and then broaden the statutes that allow Department of Health to react to any contagious disease that presents a public health risk. And I think that'll be, it's timely for that, because people are aware how one thing can lead to another. I'll give a shout out to the physicians in Mitchell who identified measles. Think about how unusual it is. We haven't had a measles case for a long time in South Dakota. And in fact, one of the reasons why we had measles in South Dakota is because someone from Kansas brought it here. And that person had been out of the country and gotten measles in India. And that person was in the hospital in Kansas. And Kansas did not detect that this person had measles. And that person came to South Dakota and gave a bunch of the family, they were visiting, the measles. But the first physician in Mitchell who saw the case said, "This is measles." So I'm very proud of our medical community in Mitchell for quickly identifying it, reporting it to the state so we could help track contacts, backtrack, and try and contain that to the a small number that it has been contained to. We're not out of the woods yet, but we're hopeful that quick action on the part of the medical community to identify it correctly will have good consequences in the end.
Well, Governor, I see that we're out of time, but I want to thank you again for talking with us for Dakota Midday.
You bet. Good to be on, Carl. Thank you.